Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Dress the History of Fashion is a production of iHeartRadio. With over 7 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Well, Dressed listeners, you asked and we listened.
Yes.
Everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, but a lot of people wrote to us or commented that they would like to hear our opinions on the Netflix hit TV show Bridgerton.
So you asked and you shall receive. It is 2021, friends.
And we should say this is probably going to be full of spoilers, possibly. I don't know where this conversation's going. April and I have not talked about it yet. So be warned. If you have not watched it, we highly recommend you do, but we might talk about some things. So you might want to watch it first and then come back to this episode.
Yes, for sure.
But I think this show, April, with everything that is going on in the world, was just the perfect form of escapism. And for our listeners who need a little refresher or might not know about this show, it's a Netflix series by showrunner Chris Van Dusen, and Shonda Rhimes production company produced it.
Which, by the way, I just did not realize. I knew who she was, but I didn't realize that, like, she was behind Grey's Anatomy and Scandal. So let's put that in context as to who Shonda Rhimes
is. Yeah, she's a production powerhouse.
Yeah, of and a writer, really hit TV showrunner. Shows. Like, yeah. She does it all, basically.
Yeah, and so she saw something in this book series by author Julia Quinn, and it's basically a romance, a Regency-era romance series of novels. And when we say Regency-era, I just want to clarify that the Regency-era follows the Georgian era, and this is in London in England. The Georgian era is so-called because of the reign of a series of kings called George. And by the time we get to King George III, who's ruling during the Bridgerton series, he's actually not ruling because he's living with a mental illness. And in 1811, because he's no longer able to rule, his son takes over and rules as a regent until his death in 1820. So when we say Regency era, that is what we're speaking about. And so Bridgerton, it follows the escapades of two families, the Bridgertons and the Featheringtons, as they embark on the opening of the 1813 London scene. So basically, the introduction of daughters to society. They go to all these balls, and it's really about hopes of making love match. Well, actually, not love matches, but people just getting married.
Matches.
Matches, yes.
It's the social scene, too.
Yeah, you know? Social scene, exactly. And everyone is awaiting the gossip column from this anonymous woman, Lady Whistledown. Julie Andrews does the voice, but we never see who it is until the very, very end. And her unsolicited insights into the illicit affairs of polite society really keep everyone on their toes, including the queen. But front and center in this story is, of course, the tumultuous relationship between Daphne Bridgerton, the diamond of the social season, and then the incredibly dashing Simon, Duke of Hastings, played by Reggae Jean Page, who has in the series vowed never to marry. So that's the little synopsis. April, we have not talked about it. I'm dying to know what you thought in general.
Okay. Well, first of all, I just want to preface this with I did watch it. And I watched it kind of early on when it first came out. And I had already watched a few episodes when you had texted me being like, watch this. How are you watching this? I'm like, yeah, I'm watching it. But I wasn't watching it or analyzing it at that time for like historical accuracy or, you know, really analyzing the costumes. I had it on. I loved it. I thought it was super fun. But, you know, sometimes I was also making dinner or, you know, on my computer or doing other things. So, Cass, you might be able to comment a little bit further in detail on some of the finer points of historical accuracy. I did go back and watch a couple of the first earliest episodes again when we decided that we were going to do this episode. But I thought it was, like you said, in this moment, it was super fun. It's playful. I was surprised by how much sex there was actually.
I was going to say, it's very sexy and erotic at times.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of graphic at certain points. I was like, oh, damn, this is not the historic, like, you know, series
that
we...
Not what we usually get. Which is amazing.
No, yeah. So, and that's also part of what it made fun. You know, it's a very much an adult show. It's not a Jane Austen novel. So my one comment when I thought about it was... in terms of it being, you know, based in history, is that they turned the volume up on right. everything. So whether it be those sex scenes or whether it be like the color palettes of the costumes. And I think another thing that people will first notice is that the cast is racially diverse. I mean, two of the lead roles, the Queen and also the Duke, are played by Black actors. And I think we're going to get into that a little bit more, but those are just kind of like some of my initial thoughts.
Yeah. And my initial thoughts were I absolutely loved it. I think a lot of our listeners, like myself, and I think you did too, just binge watched the entire thing. And then I started watching it again. And it's so funny because I was actually in a meeting with my PhD advisor, and she recommended I watched it as a respite from what's going on with the political world, with COVID, everything. And I mean, it's just so true. It really just speaks to the fact that we all really needed something like this right now. Mm-hmm. And it was really fun and I really enjoyed it overall.
Yes.
And sure. I mean, what an incredible feat of costuming, April, mm-hmm. as you mentioned. Costume designed by Ellen Majornik. And I apologize if that's not how you pronounce her name, but it's Ellen Majornik, who comes from, April, I don't know if you know this, she designed Basic Instincts, Fatal Attraction, before, you know, those kind of suspense thriller 1980s, 90s classics now, mm-hmm. Before moving on to things like The Greatest Showman and films like Maleficent. So she's very qualified to do this sort of period fantasy filmmaking. And she did this wonderful interview with Vogue, and it gives us insight into just this feat of costuming. I'm going to quote her here. She says, "It took 5 months to prepare before we went to shoot. The costume team came to 238 people."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they created 7,500 costumes.
Yes. And I think the biggest costume team I've ever worked on was 50 people. So that is insane. That's a lot of people. And then she goes on, this is inclusive of the pattern cutters, the extraordinary Mr. Pearl, who was our corset maker, a tailoring department, an embellishing department, embroiderers, and my co-captain, John Glaser. I believe he's her assistant designer, among others. It was like a Bridgerton city of elves working continuously, and they were brilliant. As you said, April, she says, in the end, there were about 7,500 pieces from hats to shawls to overcoats that made up the estimated 5,000 costumes that went before the camera. For Phoebe, who plays Daphne Bridgerton, alone, there were 104 costumes. That's a big number, even for a principal player. And yeah, what an incredible feat of costuming. And as you mentioned, April, and as we are going to go into now, this is set in 1813. It serves as the foundation for the costumes, but she really just turns up the volumes. And I love this quote for Women's Wear Daily. She says, it's like a big ice cream sundae with all the toppings. It's frothy and delicious and total escapism. And I think that's a perfect description for this perfectly delicious show.
Yes, I agree. And also she said in the press that, I'm going to quote her again. She says, being 100% historically correct was not our agenda at all. And I'm ready to get ripped over the coals if somebody wants to do it. But that's what it is. You birth it and then you let it out in the air and somebody will either not like it or they'll like it. And this is really interesting about like that kind of like frothy confection feeling cast that she is like kind of teasing out within the show. She actually says that she was partially inspired by the Christian Dior Designer of Dreams exhibition.
I read that.
Yeah. And so she kind of looked at a lot of Dior's textiles and a lot of his color palettes. So I thought that was like super duper interesting.
Yeah. The 50s and 60s, which I think Vogue described the textiles as ice cream pastels and acid bright florals. So when you look at the Bridgertons, for instance, versus the Featheringtons, there's this clear aesthetic immediately. It's almost jarring aesthetic difference. But we're talking costuming here. So historical accuracy is kind of left in the dust sometimes to help tell the story. And visually, if you have this, you know, kind of proper, you know, the respectable family, like the Bridgertons, they're all in, you know, kind of these pastel color palettes. And then you look at the Featheringtons, who are in these like jarring, like acid textiles that are amazing. And I think you mentioned in a previous conversation that the mother is like 1960s almost, it's bouffant like hairstyle.
A lot of those textiles that the Featheringtons are wearing are look exactly like textiles from the 1960s. You know, the silhouettes of the dresses are always kind of like in keeping within the Bridgertons and the Featheringtons, but it's all the other things that are telling the story. Like there are way too many sequins.
For historical accuracy.
Worn by everyone. Yeah. And, you know, the colors are not quite right. There's too much embellishment for that period. And I do want to point out that if anybody is actually fans of films from this period, usually you see that a lot of the gowns were white. Which we do see a lot in fashion plates of that same period, but we also should point out that we do see quite a bit of color in the fashion plates from that era as well. So usually the flashes of color were added by way of a coat or a shawl or gloves or hats, but color was definitely worn. So just throw that out the window that the entire Regency period was white. It was a very popular color, but it was not the only color. So if I had to kind of like say, you know, the Bridgertons are perhaps more a little bit closer to historical accuracy in terms of like the color palette, whereas the Featheringtons have just completely gone off the deep end.
Yeah, which leads us into our conversation on historical accuracy. But I do just want to say, obviously, we're fashion historians. We're going to talk about what they would have worn. But that is not the point of this show.
No.
And if you're expecting that, then you're going to be sorely disappointed, as a lot of people were, which I think is odd because it was never billed as a historically accurate show. Everything from the way it's cast to all of these, you know, the storyline and a lot of things about it are not historically accurate. And the costumes are really exemplary of that. This is a fantasy. It's escapism at its finest. And if you can just immediately upon watching the first episode, it's like, okay, I'm just going to let it go. I can't judge anything. And Ellen is right in that people had a lot to say about this, and we're going to talk about it too. But April, let's talk about the Regency era in general, just kind of as an overview, because we're talking about the post-Revolutionary War era. There's a common misconception that, you know, people burned their corsets on the fire in the French Revolution and that it was this immediate change to these high-waisted muslin gowns, but that's not actually true.
No, it's not. And as with all fashion changes and shifts in silhouette, things just don't happen overnight. I mean, we do start to see that high-waisted kind of like gossamer gown emerge at like the really kind of like avant-garde subcultures, like with the Merveilleuse, which we've already done an episode on, actually two episodes on. So you can go back and listen to those if you want to learn more. But that kind of like columnar gown with the high waist, oftentimes in white, starts to emerge in the like latter years of the French Revolutionary War. But, you know, that is not immediately adopted by everyone, right? That was kind of like, I mean, that's why they were called Merveilleuse. People were so shocked by what these women were wearing. So that was kind of like really extremely fashion forward subcultural style. And not everybody just adopted it overnight.
Right. And even before the war, like Marie Antoinette, the chemise à la reine, which was this cottony gown that she wore, it's thought that Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, had gifted her some of her chemises. So that chemise gown idea was even becoming in style thanks to Queen Marie Antoinette in the pre-revolutionary era, and then just continued to develop after that, inspired by neoclassicism and those types of ideals that continue to influence fashion in the post-revolutionary war era. And then by the time we get to 1813, we are seeing, in general, Ellen did stick to the general silhouette, which is that high-waisted, you know, so-called empire gown and that columnar line. And it's funny that you mentioned the white muslin gowns because that was highly fashionable. Mm-hmm. But Ellen said that there was a no-no for muslin gowns. She quote said, there's a limpness to them that we did not want. So, you know, it's so important when you're considering TV and film to realize that even if she wanted to be historically accurate, even if she was the leading historian turned costume designer on the Regency era, she does not have the final say in these costumes. There's so many opinions that go into it from the producers, the showrunners, the directors, and then just the script and the costume, you know, the costume as narrative. So it's kind of unfair to judge this show entirely as a product of historical accuracy, because it's just not the point.
And I'm glad you brought up Marie Antoinette, because can we just talk about this silhouettes that the queen and her attendants are wearing? Because yes, one of these other really big points of historical accuracy is that, yes, we were talking about this, you know, empire columnar silhouette from 1813 that the majority of the cast is wearing. However, the queen and her attendants are all dressed like it's the 1770s.
Right. Yep, absolutely. And it's amazing. I loved it.
Yeah.
And her hairstyles are insane. All of her wigs, all of her costumes. It's like you stepped out of one world and into another. I saw a short blip interview with Golda, who plays her. Mm-hmm. And she said there's not meant to be continuity of the queen's costumes. It's supposed to feel like she's in her own world. And I think she did. And Ellen says the queen looks like cotton candy in every conceivable flavor. So again, that candy sundae idea that this is just like over the top. And for Ellen, she really embodied what Bridgerton is all about. And that the costumes really are a testament to that.
Yes, yes. And of course, Golda Rocheville, sorry again if I'm butchering her last name, is a Black British actress. So let's talk about this. This is a really interesting decision that Shonda made to cast Queen Charlotte, who was a real historical figure, with a Black actress to play her. And so I thought it was really interesting. I started kind of like pulling the thread on that a little bit. And I found this really fascinating article, which was written a few weeks ago by Deneen L. Brown. It was published in the Washington Post. And he's talking about how certain scholars have put forth the idea that Queen Charlotte was actually descended from the Portuguese royal family who had Moorish blood in the family. So there's a lot of actual academics out there that do believe that Queen Charlotte was part Black. So I thought that was just really, really interesting in the context of quote unquote historical accuracy. And then a lot of people had a lot to say too about this question of Queen Charlotte's ancestry in conjunction with Meghan Markle coming into the British family. You know, a lot of people have said that Meghan, you know, was the first, mixed race royal. And perhaps that is not true. Potentially it was Queen Charlotte.
Yeah. And I mean, Golda just does such a wonderful job with her.
Yeah.
With that character throughout. I mean, she's so enthralled with like the lady whistle down gossip. And while her, you know, really out of place costumes were not accurate, there are portraits of Queen Charlotte she did adapt with the fashionable silhouettes of the period. But she did not allow court costume or court dress to evolve with the period. She still required women coming to court to wear these giant hoop skirts, like which are not, you know, not in keeping with the fashionable silhouette of the period. So if you look up 1813 court fashions from England versus France, they will wear these huge hoop skirts, but they did not do that in Bridgerton, which I thought was actually interesting because that is an opportunity to do an over-exaggerated silhouette, but perhaps they thought it might have been a little too comical.
Yeah. Well, actually, in my fashion plates book, there is a court costume from England in the book from this time period. And that particular one is really, really interesting because it's not that V-shaped bodice that is worn in the film that was worn in the 1770s where the waist is really narrow. This particular fashion plate from that era shows the Empire waist silhouette worn with panniers. So when you say comical, it really was. It was like this teeny tiny little bodice and then the woman was like this oval bouffant balloon on the bottom. So that may be the reason why, because it is quite a funny image. Maybe we should post it. I'll post it on our Instagram this week so you can see what I mean. You'll understand why perhaps that decision was made to stick with that classic kind of like Marie Antoinette silhouette.
Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Dress listeners, did you know that you can save on everything from fashion to beauty, home decor to groceries, even kids' school supplies with Rakuten?
Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. Beauty, clothing, electronics, home, department stores, pets, you name it. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while doing it? It really is a no-brainer.
How does it work, you ask? Well, stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via a check or PayPal quarterly.
Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. So join the 17 million members who have already saved at their favorite brands. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. That's Rakuten.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
And a couple other things. I mean, like I said, I was there for the costumes. There were two things, though, that drove me absolutely crazy. Well, one thing that drove me crazy, and that was the fact that there was no bonnets throughout the entire show. And Ellen does acknowledge that that was a conscious decision. I know that it's hard to shoot.
That's what I was going to say. Because your face is obscured. So I think that's exactly probably what that decision was.
However, it just is so out of place. I mean, these women are walking in the sun. It's completely impractical. There's no way they would have been out there without some sort of head covering. And of course, it's just part of respectable society back then. So that was pretty jarring. And then also, Daphne's hair drove me crazy because it was constantly down. And again, as a fashion historian, you know that once you reach a certain age, a marriageable age, your hair goes up as a woman. So it just made her look very young, very naive, and it just felt out of place. So that bothered me.
Maybe that was an intentional choice, though, to kind of like push forward that naivete.
Because
she's definitely sexually inexperienced. And there's like a whole plot line about her trying to figure out that aspect of her marriage.
Yeah, that's very true. And then the other thing, you'll probably join me in sharing the sentiment, is that they didn't wear chemises under their corsets, under their stays.
Oh, yeah. No.
And
no.
That's complete.
No. No. Like, there's actually one scene where you see Daphne, like, she has, like, bloody marks on her back.
Right.
Yeah. And you're like, no, she would have had a whole layer on underneath that would prevent that, or at least a little bit protected it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole corset myth, too, is something we just see time and time again. It's just a trope that's repeated in almost all period films. I mean, it's just something that, for whatever reason, our culture loves to look back and think that women did that to themselves. In reality, especially during this period, stays weren't boned because you had this flowing skirt from your under your bosom. So why would you need to tighten your waist if you weren't even going to see it? Mm-hmm. So they were more like bras or breast supporters at this period.
And a fabric, and they're like heavily reinforced with stitching, you know, multiple layers of your textile, like creating that stiffness.
But again, that's not sexy to us today. And so that's another thing we have to consider, is that even though back then it might not have been historically accurate, for modern audiences, you have to consider what people want to see and what is going to, you know, entice them. So you have to make it intriguing in other ways.
Relatable. Isn't that like a frequent word used by costumers doing historical period films, is that there's one film that or production that goes full on accurate. And then there's the other that is like trying to like bridge that connection to the modern day audience. So and I think they did that a lot with textiles in this production.
For sure. And it definitely was speaking to something. And like I said, historical fantasy, I was here for it. Did you have any favorite costumes?
Just about everything that Daphne wore. I don't know.
I loved Lady Danbury. I loved her character.
Yes.
Simon's aunt or his mother's friend who raised him. Everything she wore was all her high collars. She was amazing. Uh-huh.
There's one ensemble that she wears that was like this really deep plum purple. And it was like an iridescent taffeta.
Yeah.
Perhaps. I really loved that. And it just looks so beautiful on her, that color.
Yeah. And the gents, of course, we can talk a little bit about them. But everything that Simon wore, I mean, he just looked so dapper and dashing. And everything that he wore, I thought was fantastic as well.
I will admit that because I wasn't necessarily watching it with my eye on complete historical accuracy. Listeners, go and check out Frock Flicks. They wrote a really interesting article, and something that they pointed out, and that was that he's never wearing the correct cravat. Did you notice that? He just kind of has like his collar on and then just like a little kind of like scarf, like barely peeking out. Whereas like during this time period, a gentleman's neck would be completely covered. So if you go back and watch it, look at what Simon's cravat looks like versus the Bridgerton boys, and then you'll note that difference. But I didn't even notice it as a fashion historian when I was watching it.
Like, I just stopped, honestly. At a certain point, I just stopped and just accepted it for what it was. But I'm glad you mentioned Frogflix because there's a lot. If you want to go on a deep dive, there is so much more to be said about this show. Yes. If you want more on historical accuracy about what they actually would have worn, you can go onto YouTube, on Costube, Costuming YouTube. So many historical costumers have put forth their opinion. A couple videos I recommend is Rebecca of Lady Rebecca Fashions did a quote, a plus size rant about the fit on the costumes for Penelope Featherington. Her high waist of her gowns often cut across her bosom, which is not only not historically accurate, it wasn't very flattering. So she kind of talks about plus size fashions from that period. There's videos on men's fashions from this period, mm-hmm. women's fashions. There's videos. Abby Cox did a great one, past dress guest on the costume department. And then finally, I just wanted to say that Noelle of Costuming Drama hosted a wonderful panel on her channel, Costuming Drama, called Why Bridgerton is Problematic, Colorism, Race Baiting, and Implicit Bias. I don't think we're going to go into that here, but it includes our guest for Tuesday's episode, Christine, historical costumer Sosteen, and she will actually give us some more insights into that on Tuesday.
Yay! This was so fun. I'm glad that we got to do this.
Yeah, it was fun. And it was fun to just do an entire episode about one TV show that we both watched. And dress listeners, if you haven't watched it, go out and watch it because it's wonderful. And let us know what you thought about it, too.
It's your new favorite guilty pleasure.
Exactly. Well, that does it for us dress listeners. And yeah, get out there, watch Bridgerton. Consider making your own Bridgerton costume, perhaps, next time you get dressed.
Thank you, as always, to our producers, Casey Pegram, Holly Fry, and everyone else at iHeartRadio that makes the show possible each week. We will catch you next week on Tuesday.
Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.